thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I actually want to start with you guys just for a second, which is just a quick show of hands. How many people have seen, maybe not even this production of Our Town, but have seen Our Town? Like everyone, right? I think that's one of the great things about this conversation today, and certainly about their production. It isn't sort of the Our Town that we thought, or maybe it is more of the Our Town than we ever knew. And that's part of the fun of it. So it is with tremendous pleasure that I introduce you to two people who really don't need an introduction in this setting. David Cromer, the director, and Helen Hunt. So I actually want to start in the same place I started with them, which is even before this production. What was your first encounter with this play ever?
Okay, I was trying to watch the show Family on television in the 70s, and which Helen was on three times, it turns out. I was watching TV one night, and the Hal Holbrook TV version, does anyone remember that? It was on television, I was just sitting down to watch what I was going to watch that night, and it was on, and it just begins sort of in this empty studio with all these people walking around, and then Hal Holbrook comes on, he just starts talking right to the camera, really slowly and methodically, and explaining things, and I was just transfixed. And it had all these people I knew. It's Robbie Benson and Glynis O'Connor are George and Emily, and John Houseman is Professor Willard, and Charlotte Ray is Mrs. Soames. Seda Thompson and Ned Beatty and Ronnie Cox are the fathers. Seda Thompson is so it was this. It was all these actors I'd seen, but I'd never seen an empty. It was this sort of black void of a space, and they were miming, and then when they were doing the miming, if they were scraping a pan, you just hear, and it blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it, and I didn't know anything really about it. I think it was on in 1974, so I was 10, so I didn't know what a play was or what plays were or anything like that. Yeah, that was it for me.
And Helen?
Same.
Same.
Oh.
Exact same.
I was 10 and a half.
Yeah.
literally. I remember thinking, this is weird. Yeah. And I remember thinking Robbie Bates was so beautiful. And they were both so, even at that age, I remember how much heart was in what they were doing and how weird everything else was. And something about them on a platform in chairs. Yeah. You know, it's a very different play to see when you're 10.
Yeah.
So that was my first
encounter. And David, just to give us some context, this production has gone on quite a journey. Can you just kind of, in a nutshell, tell us where it began and how we've gotten here?
Sure. I spent most of my time based in Chicago. There's a theater in Chicago called a theater company in Chicago called The Hypocrites, of which the actress plays Emily Jennifer Grace. It's a member of that company. It's run by, or was run until recently, by a guy named Sean Graney. And we knew each other from around. We were both directors. We did things. We saw each other in bars and hung out, and he just asked me to direct a show for them that season, and I said okay, and we kicked shows around. He really wanted to do Our Town. I really wanted to do Summer and Smoke, and we went back and forth and back and forth. We kept having meetings, and I was pretty sure I was just going to go in and say, look, we should do Summer and Smoke. We should do Summer and Smoke, and I made this huge case for Summer and Smoke, and I kind of hinted that if I didn't get to do Summer and Smoke, I wasn't really that interested. And he said, okay, I understand. That's great. We're going to do Our Town. If you want to do it, you can. But if not, we're going to do Our Town. And I suddenly want to do Our Town really badly. But it flew out of my mouth. I said, okay, but I want to play the stage manager. And he said, fine, instead of no, which would have been the smart thing for him to do. And so then I agreed to do it. I love it. I just didn't really want to. You know why? Because I'd seen the Spalding Gray, the Lincoln Center one on television. And I thought that was I didn't know what you were supposed to do after that production, because I thought it was pretty fantastic. It informed me. I really loved the TV version, but the Lincoln Center version, which Miss Hunt was in as Emily, had been sort of definitive for me. So I didn't know what else to do after that. So, yeah, I agreed to do it. I did it. We kind of made it up as we went along, and 4 years later, here we are.
And you're being sort of modest. I mean, it had a couple of runs in Chicago,
yeah,
and then a 500 performance run in New York?
I think it's more than that. It was in the sixes, I think.
Ah, there's
the
modesty.
In the 600s, I think.
No, I'm not longest be, running ever.
Well, I was not trying to be I was just saying it was not. It was we were going to do it. It was in a very small theater. I think there were 80 seats. It was a room, not the exact dimensions of this, much shorter, and longer. But it was about like this, and. We just did it, and we weren't really expecting anything terribly big to happen with it. It was a production of Our Town, which is a great, 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 great play. And the more we work on it, the more we realize it's maybe one of the greatest plays. I did not assume it would become... we had no idea that it would become something that people would get as passionate about as they did. So, you know, I'm just glad it did.
And then, Helen, how did you come... Now, you saw the production in New York, and...
Yeah, I had played Emily. I took over for the girl who originated it. And then a friend of mine was one of the producers of it, and I remember, like most people, going, Our Town, huh, really? Like, it just seemed surprising that that was something people were kind of buzzing about. Because when I knew the play, I was a different age, and it didn't quite mean exactly the same thing to me, I think. And one of the many things I think of every night is how utterly mediocre I must have been in that part when I see what's happening. That's not fake modesty. I just mean it's been fully realized now in a whole different way. So anyway, I saw it, and I was very, very messed up by the end. And what happened to me, actually, is that I sat down, and then I remembered that the third act is coming and what it's about. Like, I just skipped in there like it was going to be nothing and had a hard time getting out of my seat in the end. And David and I talked on the phone. He was working on another play, and I sort of threw myself at his feet for that, and I was too young for one part and too old for the other or something. We ended up talking about, you know, meeting at the play and how much it seems to mean to both of us. Mm. And then... seemingly to me out of the blue, I got a call asking me if I would like to step into it to take over because he was no longer
in it. And when you called him, had you even considered playing the stage manager? Or was that something
he played it.
Yeah.
I didn't think there was an opening. Yeah. While it was a very flattering, tempting offer, it seemed so central to the experience that it was David, that it was someone who is not an actor first, who it's like, there's something unsettling, intentionally unsettling, about the play as written and with great precision that has been worked into the play by David. Are there mistakes? Has something gone wrong? Are we okay here? Is this a play? Have we started? You know, that those kinds of things. And one of those things was that this guy came out with a notepad and started. And I worried that if I came out as an actor, as someone well-known, that it would... I worry that I didn't want to wreck it, I guess is what I should say. So I asked David if he thought I would wreck it, and he said he didn't think that I would. And I said I didn't want to do it unless I really had time to work with him, because just, you know, skydiving and guessing is not... I'm for me, like, I love rehearsing, and then you open, and oh, well, that now it's not as much fun for me. Like, the process actually is much more fun for me. So I wanted to make sure we had a process, which we did. In Chicago, and then I stepped in.
And it really seems like a lot of your... I mean, you can almost begin from how the stage manager was approached, I think, in you directing it and playing that role. There's something very direct that from the opening moments, and there seems to be... I mean, even within Our Town, there seems to be a real lack of artifice in how you crafted that role and then how you've taken it on, and we'll talk a little bit about how that shifted. But can you talk about just what was your impulse in playing that role? Why, David, did you want to take that on?
Well, it's interesting you use the word artifice, because that's a word we use a lot. And we felt it was... when I say we, with the design team, the people, the artistic director, Sean Graney, we would just all sort of talk about the play. This continued in conversations Helen and I had. We felt like Wilder, it says no scenery, no curtain right at the beginning, so he bothers to say that right away. That's the first thing you know. So you go, why? And he says, okay, well, I don't think artists always know exactly why they do something. They sort of like say, I feel like doing this, and then maybe either somebody comes later and tells you what it means, or you think about, you have to kind of examine your impulses. And I think Wilder was sort of saying, let's strip it. Let's get rid of stuff. Let's. I just want people to look at it differently. I don't want people to. He wanted maybe people to see something just a little bit differently. Set it off to the side a little bit so you looked at it from another angle. Any way he could to play around with your perceptions of it. So if you take away all the scenery, then what is that? I don't know. It could be a lot of things, but maybe it's you look more harder at the people, or you don't say, I wonder how they do that, or I like that lamp, or whatever it is you do when you look at a set. Maybe you're forced to look at a few other things. So there was that. So then we started saying, wondering why that was, and what you'd want to strip away all the artificial stuff, the stuff maybe that keeps you distant from a show, that gives you separation, that allows you to think about that it's fake. And so we sort of explored that, and then we had to think about a lot of the things that Wilder did with the play, direct address, flashbacks, breaking the fourth wall, mime, things like that, no scenery, have become things we're used to seeing in plays, like we're really used to that. So you can go to a play and go, oh, it was one of those no set ones, you know? So we tried to figure out how to do that so that it wasn't, so that you were noticing it again.
So that you had to reawaken it in some way. That some of those things that were startling in 1938 are no longer startling in any way.
Hopefully, yeah. And so I thought it was it would be interesting to have someone who wasn't an actor and who was actually kind of running the evening, who was controlling the way the order of the evening. With Wilder gone, I was the only person left who was going to decide when it started, when it stopped, how scenes were going to go, how scenes were going to be played. So then I thought I'd just do it. And it was just an idea. It was an idea. And we were flying under the radar. I thought, like, if it's a stupid idea, we'll run for 6 weeks and we'll be done. And then of course, so that idea was fine and it was supportable, but there was really no way to maintain it if I was ever going to leave the show while it was running. So then we just had to get like wonderful actors, in which we did, and it worked fine without it. That's the reality of it. So it was just part of getting rid of as many fake things as we could, you know.
And in part of that getting rid of the fake things, one of the things I think that's so alarming about the production is the language of it. And can you talk a little bit about how you approach the language of the play? And I mean, it seems to me like you resist in the same way that you're trying to reawaken these things that were shocking then. You resist some of the cliches. You resist playing into the language or playing into the poetry. And so I'm interested in how did that approach evolve? Did that evolve in rehearsal? Was that something that you just felt was necessary from the beginning? How did that come about?
I just had a personal feel. I just, to my ear, the New England accent coupled with this language sounds cuddly, and it makes the people who are speaking in it seem sort of simple and overly pleasant. And so this is one I struggle with, because it's actually kind of it's a little bit of a violation of the script, and I just have to lay myself bare and say
why
that.
Does it say they speak with New England accent?
But some of the lines are written in dialect, like the whole town. When you say the whole town,
I say the whole town.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah. Well, I thought we could find a way to just say exactly what was written honestly, without running into this whole area of dialect. And I think we think of a Pepperidge Farm commercial.
My experience, I can say, seeing it as an audience member, was, oh no, it's me. Oh no, the mothers are there, busy. Oh God, they're. Oh no, it's me. I can't hide anywhere. I can't say it's long ago. I can't say they speak in a way people don't speak. I can't say they're. I cannot run anywhere.
Right. Right.
I have no privacy and no distance, which was what was thrilling about it. So, and I, you know, having now rolled around in the play for a couple of decades, I don't see any place that it has violated it. I mean, when they say reckon, we say reckon. Yeah. When I say the whole town, I say the whole town. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, you say, I mean, we say exactly what is written. Helen says, what with the Milkins and so on. Says it absolutely honestly, but not in a way that says, what with the Milkins and so on. You know, she just doesn't have to say it that way.
I should do that.
That would be good. We're still in previous.
We're still in previous. There's time.
There's time.
There's time.
She doesn't have to say that. Here's another example. There's something the mothers say all the time, which is, I declare. They say, I declare, you have to speak to George. Now, I have an association. I don't know what television character I'm thinking of, but I think it might be like, maybe it's like Minnie Pearl or somebody, where they're like, I declare. Did you say, I declare, before you say something? And it's just a noise we're used to making. It's something we've heard in a movie. But what it's saying is it's the equivalent of, you know, or I'm just saying, or let me tell you something. I declare, you have got to speak to George. I'm telling you, I need you to do something for me right now, and I need you to do it tonight while I'm at choir practice, is ultimately what she's saying, you know? The time has come for you to do something, honey. You know, I declare, you've got to speak to George. So you just say, you don't have to say, I declare, but you do have to say, I declare, as part of your sentence, like you mean it, and like it means something to you, and like it's something you say. So that was the approach to the language. It was to not say, we're going to hide in how it's been done before. We're going to pretend that that it's 1,000 years from now, we found the plane, we have no idea how people in New England spoke. So I'm just going to say it in the same way we have to do with Shakespeare. I'm just going to say this like I mean it and have it make as much sense as possible. So that ultimately was the approach to the language.
At the same time, though, I mean, having just done Shakespeare too, yeah. If you back away, it's over also.
Yeah.
Like people have seen this production in New York and said, he changed a little something. Like he's been very dogmatic about not a word lost, not a word changed. It's like you can't. You also do have to step right into it fully with every vowel and every consonant.
I think the Shakespeare kind of analogy is really appropriate, because in the same way, you know, almost everyone in here had seen a version of the play, you know, and I would venture a guess that half of them saw it in a high school auditorium. In the same way that we've all seen those horrible Shakespeare productions that so much is assumed, right? Mm. That, you know, we have this cliche of how to perform it, that you almost have to come at it as if it's a completely fresh text and rediscover that rather than play everything that everyone else has already staged.
Right. And that's why, sort of, to a certain extent, we were honoring Wilder's intent. Maybe we weren't obeying the letter of... We were obeying the letter of the words. Maybe we're trying to live in the spirit of the law, if not always in the letter of the law. One of the things this led us to, whether it was somehow, is a line that we got accused multiple times of adding to the play, is wherever you come near the human race, there are layers and layers of nonsense. That people don't assume that deep in the play that anyone in our town would say something critical. Mm-hmm. Because they somehow think it's a very sweet play. And it's Tappan Wilder, who's the... Thornton Wilder's nephew, and he's the executor of the estate, and he's the literary manager of the estate. The Thornton Wilder estate says, it is not a milkshake, it is a martini.
Really true.
And I'm curious, in both, Helen, in terms of taking on a role that David played, and then also in the rehearsal process originally, did you guys have to resist, those cliches? Did you have to resist the Pepperidge Farms? Or was that something that just came, that for you taking on this role, did you see it very much in the same way that he did, or?
I would be so bad at the Pepperidge Farm version that I knew that that I would, like, I wouldn't be tempted to go down that road. But, I mean, what a good director does, what David does, as much as anybody I've ever worked with, is it's almost like wearing infrared glasses, looking at the play. Like, I think I see it, and then it's not often a great idea from over here. It's an ability, in my opinion, what makes a director great is an ability to look like, oh, it was right there. It does say. It says it right there. So the choice is complete. Like, that's the beauty of working on a good play. Like, why am I still doing Our Town is a decent question.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is that when all is lost, you look, and you look harder, and hopefully you're working with someone who has this weird ability to look through whatever parts of you are asleep about it and say, no, right, let's do this, because this is actually what it says. So again and again, you know, you come back to something that you trust with all of your heart and soul, which I do feel about this play.
And stepping into this, did you have trepidation about taking on this role? I mean, I think again, one of the beautiful things about you in this role and in this production is that it's one of those decisions that, you know, you sort of read these other things and say, like, oh my goodness, a female playing the stage manager. And then after you've seen it, you're like, well, of course, I mean, it's beautiful, of course.
It's weird. That I didn't count on. I've had people who have said to me, and Jennifer, who plays Emily, had friends from college who said, what do you mean it's not written for a woman? Because, again, when you look at it through that lens, there's so much talk about mothering. And, I mean, I was shocked at that, and people remark about it all the time. And my stepson said, when I told him David played it originally, a man played that part? Can you believe it? A man played that part? But I wasn't worried about the gender. I wasn't worried about being right for the part, because I don't know what it says about me that I feel vaguely right for the part, but I do. But what I was worried about is in this production that was such a slave to unpretentiousness and lack of artifice, I wasn't the director. So who am I? What I said on the phone is, who am I to go out there and tell anybody anything about anything? And so now I have like a little list. I found out this year my great-great-grandfather was born in a small town in New Hampshire. That helped. I seem to have some pretty lasting relationship with the play. That's conspicuous to me. So my interest in it, I guess what I have that to honestly bring out there is a decades-long interest in the play. I have that that I can walk out with.
And what is that, and what was it like for you, David? Was there a kind of recalibration of the play? Because in the sort of second and third acts, there are all of these things that suddenly, you know, some of the things that you say to the mothers, and certainly things that you say in the marriage, that you almost can't imagine it the other way, even though, you know, that's the way that we all know it. So was there any kind of recalibration of the play, or was that something that you just allowed the audience to do? And then also, what was it like for you, Helen? You know, in a sense, you've played both sides of the scene in the third act. And what was that journey
back?
Well,
you look, as an actor, you just start by looking for what is actually true, because the rest is the work you have to do and you don't want to work much. So what is actually true? And I realized when we were rehearsing, one thing that is true is that when I tell her, you know, there is a scene in the third act where Emily, the central woman in that act, wants to go back to her life and see what it was like before she died. And I say, don't do it. I'm telling you, don't do it. And I have done it. So I realize I have actually done it, you know, on a stage a few decades ago. So there I had one that was real, you know, like that. And again, like my interest in the play is sort of the biggest thing I hang on to. It's the honest thing.
Yeah. And that was, and there was... It didn't need to be recalibrated. We just needed to look again, like you said, for the things that rang out, that fit, that mattered to you. The night Helen saw the show, which was long before any conversation about her ever going. I mean, if we had ever thought about you going into it that night, my guess would have been like, "Gee, I wonder if she'd play Mrs. Gibbs or something." Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it would be like, but then who would we get to be? You know what I mean? I probably wouldn't have thought that exact thing. But what happened when we met in the lobby was you just had all of these things to say about the play, and you were just pouring out. It wasn't just you liked it. It wasn't it was compliments, but it was just talking about it and talking about what it meant and talking about how it affected you and talking about your daughter and to a stranger, you know? So very generous, very open, very passionate, very like sort of strong about it. Then we had that conversation. We might have talked about that other play for 35 seconds, 35 seconds. And then I feel like we talked well over an hour and just about the play and about life and about parenting and about aging, about, you know, just maturing, about like what it meant to us when we were young, what it meant now, what we thought about, you know, where a young person loses interest in the play and where an older person picks up interest in the play. We had a student matinee the other day, and
oh my God,
they were terrific, and they were the squirming mass of high school students, the way high school matinees are, and they, you know, made a little too much noise in places, but you just heard the things about maturity, about aging, about your life going by meant absolutely nothing to them, which is fine. Which is fine. Why would it? Why should it? Good Lord, you should start worrying about that when you're 16? No. But then all the stuff that was all the other things about, like, love and do people like me and am I pretty and you know what I mean? I'm scared. All of that stuff. Is the moon going to crash into the earth? You know? Just rang. My 12th birthday, where my mother, you know, like, what it would be like to not see my mother ever again.
And the play begins with the young people rolling their eyes at the mothers,
yeah,
and ends with a different kind of appreciation of the mothers. And to see this group,
yeah,
of kids give it up. They went from, you know, one of the things I do at the beginning of the play is set up the town that we're in, and I say, right here is the church, and right here is this, and here's a tree, and one of the kids said, where? And I just looked at him and said, right there. And he looked, and he, like, outweighed me by a lot. Had his legs on the stage. And then he looked, and he nodded, like, I see,
yeah,
it.
Right.
So he gave it up. But to see that group be wrestled into something else by the end, that's when you have to bow to this play and say, are,
yeah,
you kidding? Like,
and the other
that
thing
it can do that.
The other thing that's so wonderful about, you know, first just staging it in that long thrust, mm, but, you know, you're in relationship to the audience, and the audience really plays a role in this production in a really meaningful way.
It's very hard to rehearse this part without them, I will say that. Yeah. I was looking at a bunch of chairs, and, you know, when they come in, as terrifying as they are, also, it's a great relief to have people to talk to.
You don't have your scene partner until we get into performances.
Yeah.
You don't have anyone really to act with. We can theorize about acting. You could recall certain things that had happened when you played it in New York, but otherwise the relationship to the audience is like they don't necessarily want you. You had said when you saw it, you were like, oh crap, you know, like the lights didn't go down or something. No.
Well. You know, the house lights don't go out in a traditional way, and I just thought, oh, no, there's nowhere to hide. It was another example of there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah, it's very, very naked production.
And everybody is, which is true, which is why theater is different than movies. God knows, all due respect to movies. You know, we are in a room together. Something real could happen. A phone could go off. Someone could cry. Someone could fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
A lunatic could come, you know, like, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. But when the lights go out, you go, oh, just one more, just quickly, I'll be the babysitter.
Yeah.
One last
yeah,
text off. But in this play, we're all culpable. We have to take responsibility for the fact that we've walked into the space and asked to be together. It's different, I think.
Yeah.
And Wilder seems to have written something that tries to at least touch on the biggest things we have to deal with, the biggest things we have to think about, and he wrote a play, and he put it in a theater, and he said in the very first line, this play is called Our Town, it's a play. So we all just have to be in the room together, you know what I mean, and tough it out, and like go on, and he takes it on a very long journey. He puts the stage manager in the position of not telling you where you're going to be taken at all. The production evolved in this way that had to be just without boundaries.
If you look at all the tricks he has, I never thought about it till right now. But part of you, when you sit down into a play and you go, "All right, convince me," because I know I'm in Santa Monica. So
yeah,
go ahead. And the play says, "I'm not trying to trick you at all. It's a play. This is what it's called. This is where we are. This is who did it." So then, well, you kind of lose that one. And, well, the house lights, so I don't have that one. It has a way of disarming you, which is harder and harder to do, I think,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and I think it's what's so beautiful about how you've approached the design elements in the piece as well, right? That the modern day dress, like going last night at intermission, it was wonderful. Two guys behind me said it's so wonderful how they decided to do it without any costumes, right?
Right, which is a big testament to the costume design,
right? Which is hiding the art is perhaps the most difficult thing, but it's sort of lovely that, as you said, it reduces the distance that we have from, like, the period costumes, mm-hmm, or from the theatrical lights, or that it is very much happening right here.
So that it can devastate you later. So that it can mess you up something good.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, and everyone has to put, you know, you were saying earlier about, like, what happens if I go out, what if you go out there, what happens with a well-known person, what happens with someone that they're used to. Everyone has to put all of their ego. The design, I mean, the reason I'm starting this sort of point is the designers had to be egoless because people were going to think they hadn't done anything. Yeah. And the actors had to be egoless because they did not get to do interesting things actors do. They did not get to show off. They did not have to do, you know what I mean? They don't have to hit, they don't get to say, like, I've got this little moment here, and I've got a good, I can get a laugh here and a tear, and I get to turn and sell it with a look. You know, we all had to, and I don't get to do anything sort of fancy visually, and I don't, you know what I, you don't go out there and try to, you're not showboating out there at all. It's completely straightforwardly, I'm giving you this information. I'm just here to take you through this, you know. The calibration that evolved here, I wanted to answer. Go back to an old
Absolutely.
Question, which is the calibration that happened here was that there was sort of this thing that fell in our lap here, which I thought was so exciting, was because this is where you live, and because you have been, even if you had never gotten involved with it, the way you talked to me about the play was just you were glad. You liked it, and you thought people should see it and think about it, and to bring it out here and to say to your community and to say, "Hi, guys, come in. I not only do you know you're in Santa Monica, I know you're in Santa Monica, but I'm going to show you this play and take you into it." So everything you see is really happening. You know, she says they're actors at the beginning of the play. She's clearly Helen Hunt. You know, we're not pretending you're someone mm-hmm. else, and so And all of those things, a bunch of actors from here, a bunch of actors from there, a very, very famous actor, it doesn't matter because we're all just in this room, the lights haven't changed, we're all wearing the same clothes, and eventually we just think about all of these things that are our daily life, our anxieties about who we're going to spend our time with, and our feelings about what in the world could possibly come after, you know? It is an enormous equalizer. Like, everyone comes in different, and ideally, Wilder was trying to give us this opportunity to, like, it doesn't matter. It didn't matter that everyone in the 1974 version was a movie star or a TV star. It didn't matter, because eventually they were just all in our town, you know? Yeah.
And in terms of, you're just at your beginning of your time here in L.A., but have the audiences, has the audience response been different from Chicago to New York to here? I mean, or is it, you know, I think one of the things that the play does is it dances along sort of the universal and the very, very specific. You know, you have the green beans, but then you have these things that are sort of cosmic in a sense. Have you found that the audience have come in differently to it, or has it been an equalizer?
I'll say one thing, which is there's a theme running through the play. One of the characters wants to do something before she dies, and she has trouble saying it directly, and I and David really pointed that out, and everyone's worked on that theme, and I thought, well, that's, very few people are going to actually get that, but they'll get the spirit of that. But then in the third act, I really sit with the audience, and I now hear the minute the line that refers to that mm-hmm. happens, five people go, like they are hearing it. Which is very exciting to me.
I do think they're the same, but only in the
they're
same
listening.
That, yeah,
really hard.
Yeah, well, I do, and I think they're the same. I think they're only the same in terms of where you are in your life and where you are in your life that day. And I think that's ideally the thing that maybe we should try to remember when we're doing plays, that that's ideally going to be everyone's experience, or that's ultimately going to be everyone's experience, which is I ate this, I'm in this bad mood, I got this phone call right before I came in, whatever it is. That is the case. So everyone's going to have, we should cherish the experience they're going to have, not the experience we want them to have necessarily. And, you know, if you are partway through your life and wondering whether you're going to get to do some of the things you wanted to do, which you were sure you were going to do when you were 20, and you're really not sure you're going to do when you're 47, and, it depends on when you see the play. Yeah. So when we have high school students who don't care about some of these things, which is fine, they shouldn't care about it. Some of those issues of mortality, that's their experience. And then with a big audience, with a mixture of it, you understand. And you can see them and sit with them. You have just this sea of people who are going to be, this guy's asleep. She hates it. He loves it. You can see them all, you know,
yeah.
And then that's, it just is.
I mean, that's the other part of the wonderful part of the show is being in relationship to the audience. Is last night I was sitting directly across from this mother and maybe her 13 or 14-year-old daughter, right? And the two of them were there, and during the kind of proposal marriage moment, you saw both of their histories, and you saw her aspiration and the mother's history all coming together, and the experience of that became this sort of wonderful backdrop for the play. And then there's that other wonderful moment that you have of asking the audience to remember back to the moment when they were first in love, and you see these people in the audience lean forward in this beautiful way. It's the sort of play that you almost want to go see twice, once to watch the play, and then the other to watch the audience watching the play. Do you get a chance at all during the... I mean, how present is the audience for you? You're right there with us.
Yeah, they're all I've got, basically. I always have the experience by the end of feeling utterly responsible for them, which is ridiculous because I'm playing a part, and but I do feel... very responsible for them, and I also know the courage it takes to actually wade into the play, whether you're working on it, but attending it takes some courage. You may not know that's what you've signed up for, but if you really listen, here's what I know, everybody in the audience that I come out with is going to say goodbye to someone someday at the end of their life, and maybe the person sitting next to them. So I come out with a lot of very seemingly mundane things to say, but when I really started to work on it, I thought there's not a person in the room that I'm going to be talking to who isn't going to have that moment. It's like, holy God. So, you try to walk a tightrope of having a light touch about that and being mindful of it. And so if he's asleep, maybe it's for the best. and it's like I said, it's a very alive thing, as theater always is, but even a little bit more so in this case because of the theme of the play and because of the way David directed it. It's, scary in every night, which is great.
Yeah, we say it's a great play so much that it might start to lose its meaning for us. there's things you say over and over again, and they lose their meaning, just like you do something every day and it starts to lose its meaning and you don't realize you should really pay attention to certain thing, because they might be gone someday. And of course, you can't live like that. I understand that. But we're so used to saying the play is great. But as it sounds like, I sound sometimes like I'm patting myself on the back, like I think the production's so clever. It's got some nice ideas in it, but the play really, really, really is. I don't know. Maybe more now than it was. I'm never a big believer in now more than ever. You know what I mean? I think that things like this maybe are always powerful, but there's something about hearing this play again right now that has kind of wigged people out a little bit.
And do you have any sense of that? I mean, because you've remounted this play that was written right in 1938, sort of after this. Yeah. Tremendous moment in the United States, right before another tremendous moment, and this production began in Chicago, in 2008?
2008.
And so you've really wrote out, to say the least, an interesting moment in American history with this play. Do you feel that those two things are speaking to each other? Is that?
I've been anxious my whole life. I've always been anxious. I don't remember. I talk to people who say, it was just the 70s, it was a simpler time. A simpler time? Hands up, come on. It was like we thought everything was going to complete hell in a handcart. We had any sense of faith in government had been completely decimated. I won't enumerate the 70s, but the idea that that would become suddenly some other thing. We've always been anxious, we've always been scared. I think it's just a matter of when. Whether you're going to be exposed to something that's going to allow you to feel that way, and maybe not feel like it's something you have to face alone, or that it's a private thing.
So then, what is it about this? What is it about this play in this moment? When you say that there's something special about hearing it now, what are you pointing to? What's that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think maybe we can't. I think it. it I don't know. I want to say the reason I brought up the 70s is I don't know. I think we've always been anxious, but I think that we. It might be just where I am in my life now. It might be that I don't think I'm going to. I don't think I can believe that everything's going to be okay anymore.
Well, there's also, we're all living with this environmental, yeah, internal, you know, what? Terror?
Yeah.
You know, and you don't even need that to have the play be relevant, but it, you know. Yeah. But that's part of it, yeah. I think, right? Yeah. I think we're all pretty awake to that.
So I was not able to answer that question and on your question about that on any level. I don't know. It's you know, every day you wake up. You know, there's a line in the play. There's a line in the play which has currently become my favorite, which is the strain is so great that every 16 hours everybody lies down and gets a rest. There's a point where it's like, I can't take it. I got to lie down, and then because I've got to get up tomorrow and do it. And I think as you go on in your life, you go, it's just going to keep coming. It's just going to keep coming until it suddenly stops. So, like, I really don't want it to keep coming, but I also don't want it to stop. Maybe that's
the
exact,
it is.
You know, I was watching, it might have been not this time because it's been so long since I've seen it, but I think there was a point where I was watching some replacement or some put in New York, and I was just counting scenes, just going, like, how many more seconds? Scene till the act is over. I want to get out of here. And I realized I was telling time to hurry up so that I could apparently get closer to my own death. With apparently, I go, come on, hurry, so that I can get to my grave. What was I trying to do? Where was I trying to be? You know, this play's about breakfast and mortality. You know what I mean? So, like, two of my favorite things. You know.
Great. We have a few minutes. If there are any questions from the audience, we can entertain them. Yeah? Yes, sir.
When Thornton Wilder wrote the play, the staging was beautiful, I thought. How did the actual staging differ from his thoughts?
Yeah. I've only seen photographs of the original production. It was directed by, produced and directed by a man named Jed Harris, who was an incredibly famous, revered director of his time, upon whom Laurence Olivier based his performance in Richard III. Apparently he was a terrible, terrible, terrible guy. He said Richard, he was playing Richard, you know, if you've ever seen the Olivier film of Richard III, he's doing Jed Harris, who produced and directed our time. There's photographs of it. It is a bare stage. There is a wall of radiators on the back of the stage, which is that's how those theaters were heated. They're wearing clothes from from the period that the play takes place in, which at that time was really only a generation or two before. It's written in the script that two trellises are supposed to be brought on to indicate the gardens. That George and Emily are supposed to climb ladders. That the props are imaginary, and that's really all we know about it. And there's some photos of it. So configuration changed, but ultimately it's not. They're where the people are dressed in a way where you know who they are and what they do and where they live. And we mime the props, and there's only supposed to be two tables and eight chairs, and so not really that different, I don't think.
Great. Other questions? Yeah.
A question for Ms. Hunt. Actors as different as Orson Welles, Frank Sinatra, Paul Newman have.
I'm always in this list.
I've never thought of that.
So it's the among the people who have played the stage manager, Orson Welles, Frank Sinatra, etc. What do you bring to this?
Gosh, I don't know compared to what they brought, but I bring love and fear, a love of the play, a very big relationship with mothering. And to me, you know, because of where I'm sitting, the play is startlingly about that. I mean, it's also about falling in love, and it's also, so much of it is about trying to be in a relationship and trying to be a parent. and I'm living in that. So I bring some pretty strong feelings about that. I bring an absolutely indescribable but very important to me interest in what it's all about, yeah. Why we're here and what's going to happen and how to, you know, survive, not surviving. And the play, which David has helped me see, while one might think it gives a lot of answers, what it gives is all these questions. And I think that's a big thing that David has given to the play is, again, like with the infrared glasses that a good director has, over and over I say, do you know what I mean? What do you think? Do you think? What do you think? Do you know what I mean? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you know what I mean? That's written into the play. And I think usually those questions are played as if they're rhetorical. You know what I mean? It's not, I'm actually every night pick someone who maybe might have something to say about it, and I really ask them, and, you know, so I bring that, thanks to David, but I have invested in that fully. So I bring an honest burning curiosity about the things that the play is about. So I don't have any, I don't bring answers, but I bring a burning interest in it.
Yeah. I want to jump in just because I want to say something nice, which I mean, which is you bring, it's a word you used earlier, which is you said you feel responsible for the audience. You bring responsibility for the audience's experience. Like you compared it to parenting. I mean, maybe you didn't compare it to parenting, but no. One of the first things you said, and in all of our conversations, has always been about parenting. And so I would not say anything as adorable as the stage manager as a parent to the audience, but you take responsibility for the experience of the audience. And I'm not saying any of those other people didn't, although I would bet Frank Sinatra wasn't maybe that responsible.
I'm going to say, maternal.
In other ways, maybe he was responsible in other ways, but slightly less maternal. But that's a huge part of it, and I think it's funny because that's kind of when we realized today that on that list that we were just looking at a list of things the stage manager says, and we realized one of the order was wrong on something of a list.
I was saying
she says,
it wrong.
Yeah, that's the short version of what was happening. No, but the list is the first thing the stage manager refers to is about relationships. The first line is mother and daughter.
She lists the mothers and daughters, husband and wife, enemy, but the first thing she says is
mother and daughter. So that not only is what is recalibrated simply by the fact that Helen's playing it, but it is also almost every conversation has been these subjects are difficult, and the other thing you've always said about it, which is these subjects are complicated, and you're not crazy for worrying about this. You know, which no. I think is a pretty responsible thing to do to an audience, which is you might think you're crazy for freaking out about this, but you're not. It's an act of mercy, I believe, which does not require someone to be cuddly. It requires someone to be responsible and kind. You know, and so that's what I think you bring, if I may say.
Thank you. You may say.
We have time for one more question. Yeah.
I've had the good fortune to study the original manuscripts of the play and the correspondence leading up to it, so I know what great depth of philosophical thought went into writing it. But I'm always astonished to meet people who think it's just a piece of sentimental Americana. Mm-hmm. What do you say when you encounter people like that?
So the question is, when someone thinks it's the Pepperidge Farm sentimental play, what do you say to them? Other than, come see the show, probably.
I really do think that's the honest answer. Yeah. He can't say it because he directed it. I do think that's, it's not perfect, nothing's perfect, but I do think that what he has done is everybody's best attempt to get to the heart of this very horribly relevant, weirdly funny and immediate piece of writing. I think that's true. Go ahead.
And I have not actually encountered someone who said the play is this. Oh, that's not true. That's not true. John Simon, the critic, loathed this production, loathed it. And I think he was writing Bloomberg at the time. And I read press, and I get mad about it or not mad about it, or I'm fine about it. I mean, I'm not too crazy about it. I'm not too insane about it, I don't think. But he said he was mad that it was not sweeter. He was furious and angry that it wasn't nice. And I did not get to speak to him, but I would say, you know, Mrs. Soames has a line in the graveyard. How'd somebody die? And she says, in childbirth. Mrs. Soames says, childbirth, huh? Forgot all about that. My, wasn't life awful and wonderful? My, wasn't life awful? I say, Simon Stimson says, that human beings wander around trampling on the feelings of those about them. They spend and waste time as though they had a million years. They're ignorant and blind, I'm paraphrasing. And Mrs. Gibbs says, Simon Stimson, that ain't the whole truth, and you know it. It's not the whole truth. So it's just, it's written in, you know what I mean? It's like, please refer to the text. It says, it is filled with horrible things. It is filled with cruel things. It is filled with failures. It is filled with someone who just missed hearing what someone they loved needed and never got it right.
And it says, Earth, you're too wonderful for anyone to realize.
Yeah, yeah. And it says that. Yeah. Do human beings ever realize life while they live it every minute, you know? So it is all those things. And so that's, I would say to that person, look at that and read it more carefully, simply because it'll give you more. The play will give you more.
What a wonderful place to leave it. I want to thank all of you for joining us and being part of this conversation. I want to thank our hosts at the Broad Stage for sharing the space and bringing this beautiful production to Los Angeles, Dale Franzen, Mitch Heskel, and David Toledo for being our hosts today. We really appreciate that. This podcast will be on kcrw.com/theater starting on Tuesday. You can catch me at Opening the Curtain, which airs on Tuesday afternoons at 4:44 on KCRW 89.9. And most importantly, let me thank these two folks who, at the end of a tech preview week, have shared an additional hour of their time with us. So thank you very much, Helen and David.